just talk, talk.
These are the people at the heart of racing. Their lives, their stories, in their own words.
Yeah, racing. I mean, that's where it started, Michael. That's really the beginning. That's where it burned as a kid.
We'll talk about the champion, Black Caviar.
Black Caviar was a freak. So was the trainer.
No, the first Melbourne Cup I was involved with was a horse called Gadam Gadam.
Gadam Gadam.
I was listening to an RSN interview with John Hawkes, and he said, I think it's a really average guineas this year.
This is a very sad story, but making sure that, you know, that his head was upright.
See TJ Smith or Bart Cummings in the background, and you're just in awe.
Follow a lot of sports, but the sport I'll follow most closely will be horse racing.
For the next hour, RSN 927's Racing Pulse presents Racing's Open Mic.
And I'm thrilled to cross codes this morning to have Chris Elford in the studio, an old mate from yesteryear. In the meantime, he's chalked up about 7,000 wins. That's how long it's been since I've seen him, and that's how long it's been since Chris Elford's been in the studio because he got lost. How are you, Chris?
Yeah, great. Thank you, Matt.
Taking directions from Adam Hamilton, I believe.
Yeah, sort of. Knew the general area, but he couldn't help me with the last pinpoint details and took me another 10 minutes to find it.
Well, you still got here on time, which is fantastic. Hey, it's been such a long time since I've seen you and such a long time since you've been in this studio, but in the meantime, you have just kept accumulating winner after winner after winner, and you're closing in on 7,000 as a driver, which is a number that I'm sure our listeners will be just thinking, how do you squeeze 7,000 wins into such a short lifetime? And then you're hovering on 99 Group 1 wins as well. Do you, when you look at those numbers, do you wonder how you ever found the time to achieve it?
Pretty much. It sort of goes back, like we can start racing when we're 16, so it's been a fairly long time, and I'm 51 on Saturday, so I've been going around for a while. But, when I started, I could never imagine, doing anything like this.
Well, we'll talk to you about your background too, and of course you and your dad Barry, and even down to Noopy Kiosk, who I've lied to people. I actually told people that I drove him at your place once, and I actually didn't. I drove the horse behind him, but it was just a little white lie. We'll talk about Noopy and the art of driving and all those sorts of things, but chalking up, you're not like the batsman who's on 99 who's hovering and can't get to the 100. When are you going to chalk up the 100 Group 1s?
Hopefully it'll be soon, maybe this Saturday night with Tell Me Tales. She's got a good chance in the big mares race. So, it'll come eventually. And wasn't that long ago I got to 99. So hopefully we can get over it soon.
Do you feel like you've lived 7,000 wins? Does it feel like you've chalked up that on the clock to you?
Some days my body does. I get a bit of aches and pains and that, and especially in the winter. But, I still remember my first winner like it was yesterday.
How is your body holding up? We often hear about jockeys and the rigors of race falls and all that sort of stuff, and hips and ankles and knees and things like that, and keeping going. It's a different art form being a driver, but it's still very physical. How do you feel at age almost 51?
I've been pretty lucky with falls. I think once I broke my leg and just kept racing, I think it was just like a fracture, but just kept going. And touch wood, apart from that, I've had only sort of broken ribs and things like that, nothing major. But all the big falls, they end up sort of seem like they compress your body. I feel like I'm shrinking a bit.
You are. Biologically, you are.
Yeah.
Your daughter Maggie's now way taller than you. And just for an interesting timeline, I remember when I would go up with Adam Hamilton up to Romsey Lancefield.
Belinda, yeah.
Yeah, and look at Noopy Kiosk, who was the champion trotter of the day, trained by your dad and driven by you. And you had a little daughter called Maggie at the time, who was an ankle biter. And I saw a tweet from you the other day about trying to chase up a ticket to her graduation from something. What's the story there?
Maggie was graduating in a course in veterinary nursing, and let me know about a month before the graduation that she'd like me to come if I could. And that day I didn't have races, so being me, I left it till about a week before that to get a ticket. And when I rang the Box Hill TAFE, said no, tickets are closed. So I was all out of luck, which annoyed her a little bit when I told her. And thankfully a guy that I drive one or two horses for had a contact there and was able to get me a ticket, so it all worked out well in the end.
You must be proud of your daughter, because in horse sports, in gallops, it's a bit of a closed shop community sometimes. Sometimes the assumption is that your sons and daughters follow in your footsteps, and I'm sure Maggie could have, but she hasn't, and she's become a real star in her field. You must be a really proud dad.
Yeah, that's for sure. She's excelled in what she wanted to do, and I think she actually won, Student of the Year last year, which was a huge buzz for her.
Absolutely. Now, I want to talk to you about all the highlights of your career. There's Golden Rain, there's Lenny the Shark, there's Mont Denver Gold, there's intense rivalries, including one with a guy who you nearly had a punch on with once, who's going to join us to talk about the development of a rivalry into a friendship, and that's Gavin Lang. And also some of the little quirks of your life, including your fascination with serial killers, but your disdain for hitchhikers and fear of spiders. So, but let's talk first about the beginnings of your life and your career. And your dad, of course, was a trainer. Were you beyond that generation? Is there a rich harness racing history through Chris Elford's veins?
Not really. My dad used to work for the PMG and was an apprentice jockey before that, and got too heavy. And as we lived in Romsey, he was in the butcher shop once, which was owned, I think, by Jerry Layler, who was the chief steward later on. And he just happened to bump into Dot Lang there one day and went down and started giving Langs a hand and got the bug for harness racing, and it all started from there.
And how did you sort of enter into the frame there?
He used to rent stables not far out of Romsey, and then eventually bought the land down at Belinda, and I left school sort of when I was about 13, nearly 14.
Wasn't your caper?
I was not great at it, but didn't really like it that much, so as soon as I got special permission off the government, I was allowed to leave and start working at the farm.
And these were the roaring days of harness racing, weren't they? I imagine they were the late 70s, the 80s, basically, weren't they, pretty much?
I think I started driving in 84, so, about the, as you said, late 70s, early 80s, I was really getting into it.
Well, the vintage era for me of harness racing was the Hondo Grattan and all that sort of stuff through the Paleface Adios, but then into the popular arm Gamelite era. Was your imagination captured by those legends of a sport that probably back then it had a bigger profile than it does now?
Oh, that's for sure. There were great horses back then, and we used to get, big crowds, and we had guys like Brian Gath and all that were pin-ups. I remember when I was a little kid one night watching, I think it was a race at Moonee Valley with Brian Gath on the lawn, and Gamelite won the race, I think, and after that race he gave me a little pat on the head and said, "You just keep at it, son, you'll get there."
So what was it like? I mean, you talk to apprentice jockeys about how complicated it is to learn how to ride a horse, and I think the assumption might be that harness racing driving isn't as risky or as complicated, but I'm sure it is, because I remember when I drove the horse behind Looper Chaos that day, I felt like I was going to slide off all the time. There's no safety and comfort there. How was the early development of you as a driver? And I'm sure there were some heart and mouth moments there.
There was. I think the first time I ever drove a horse, Dad put me on one that, anyone could drive first go, and I went out on the track and must have forgot to steer it, and it went up a drain and tipped me off, and then it just stood there and waited till I got back on and went again. So my first drive wasn't probably great, but, doing track work for a couple of years before I got to the trial sure helped me, that's for sure.
How risky is it? I mean, you see some spectacular tumbles where the cart basically slingshots the driver in the air, and there was one day where Adam Hamilton and I had an all-up parlay with Tubby Peace, and the seat broke and he ended up on his bum on the track when he was 40 metres in front. Well, how dangerous can it be? There's a list of jockeys who have perished doing what they love, but I'm sure there's a lot of dark history with harness racing as well.
Yeah, there probably is. There probably hasn't been, as you said, as many fatalities as what there is in the gallops. They're probably a lot higher and hit the ground a lot harder, but when we fall, we've got carts and everything smashing into us, and it's a lot safer now with the tracks, and a lot of the horses are so much better now than what they were in the old days. So, every now and then there's a spill, but usually it's pretty good.
I want to ask you about the evolution of the horse and the tracks. I mean, I've never known a sport where the times have so spectacularly shortened, become quicker than in particularly trotting, but yep, also in pacing. How much is that down to the advancement of the tracks, and how much to the advancement of the breed?
Yeah, I think breeding's got a lot to do with it. The horses are just so well bred now, especially the trotters, but the tracks are good, and now we have the more revolutionary sort of carts that are sort of styled on the American ones, a bit shorter. They seem to help them a lot.
I remember when Popular Arm time trialled in 1:53.2, it was seen as this wow time. Internationally, they were running quicker, like Nihilator and all those were running quicker in the US, but that was seen as an unbelievable benchmark time. But these days, you can go around in Bendigo in 1:53.5 or 1:54. How much quicker, how would Popular Arm and Gamalite be competitive against the champions of today?
Oh, for sure. They'd be still champions. I know the times from when I started racing at Moonee Valley, if you won an MO, they're going 2 minutes, you were absolutely flying. And horses now that we work at home that can go to the races and run 1:56 can't work with the horses that used to run 2 minutes years ago. So, you know, that's just how much better the carts and gear and all that is.
Why are the trotters so much quicker? They're 10 seconds quicker than when I was a kid. How is this so?
I think it's just all in the breed now. They're all so finely bred, and you know, a lot of American and more so European trotters, stallions getting over here sure helps.
Tell us about your early career before we get to these massive moments of Golden Rain and Mont Denver Gold and Lenny the Shark and all these other things and all the big stage things that happened. But I imagine early days there was a lot of back roads, a lot of long hours on the road, a lot of toil and not a lot of recognition.
Yeah, that's true. Everyone, you know, you've got to start at the bottom before you can work your way up. But luckily I had my dad, and my first couple of drives were for him, and first two were pretty bad. And then we went to Wangaratta one night and had two drives and got a double, so that was the start of it. And then I think my fifth race, I got a freelance drive for a guy called Johnny Bickerdike at Yarra Glen, and because I was 16, I didn't have a car or anything, so I had to get my nan to drive me over to Yarra Glen, and the horse ended up winning, so that was the start of it all. And I remember that day he come up to me after the race and gave me $300, and I nearly died. I said, oh, I can't accept this. And he goes, mate, he said, just never knock back a sling. You don't get them that often.
Well, that's right. It reminds me a bit about when you're the surfer who surfs a wave, when there's a group of guys who've got ownership of that wave and they make life difficult. When you're a young driver and there's the established drivers, is there a bit of a pecking order that you have to sort of fit into for a while?
Yeah, there probably is. You know, you try not to step on the toes. Like, I used to get on the track and be sort of half scared of guys like Brian Gath and Teddy Demler, and didn't want to upset them on the track or things like that. But after you go around for a while, you sort of, you know, just strengthen up and go and do your best.
And I've got to ask you about Vinnie Knight, because we lost Vinnie Knight 20 years ago?
Yeah, probably more, actually.
And he was the guy who electrified the sport. And when people talk about the slightly diminished profile on harness racing, they say it started to go that way after they lost their showman and their megastar in Vin Knight. I know there was the Brian Gaths and all these other Bulldog Nicholsons and that at the time, and Ginger Gleason, and
yeah.
But three of them were patients of my father in Bacchus Marsh. What was it like in the era of Vin Knight?
Yeah, I didn't actually race a great deal with him. I think I'd only just begun not long before he passed away. And I was at the trials one day at Kilmore just when I was going for my license, and jogging one round the warm-up, and he sidled up beside me and, how you going? Yeah, good thanks. And I was like, wow, he's actually speaking to me. And he said, oh, you better pull up at the start and I'll move the seat a bit forward for you because your legs are a bit short.
Was that a taking the P155 out of you, or were your legs really that short?
Oh, no, I was pretty short then, but, you know, he was just having a joke, and that's the way he was.
Has there ever been a figure like him in harness racing?
Probably not anyone as flamboyant as he was. He was a great trainer and his horses were amazing, and he drove them like that, and you know, his salutes are legendary, and he sure did light things up.
It was almost like, where were you the day Kennedy was shot, or where were you the day the man landed on the moon? Do you remember the day that you heard about Vin Knight, the death of Vin Knight?
Yeah, I was actually at the airport on my way to Port Pirie for a invitation driver's thing. That was the day, yeah.
And do you remember your reaction?
Yeah, it was pretty much just shock, and I think they even cancelled the races that day, or a lot of guys just didn't even drive.
Yeah. Talking with Chris the Puppet Alford, and I'm going to ask him why he's called the Puppet too. I think I know. SMS us on 0416 90 50 52 if you want to have a chat to Puppet, or if there's anything you want to ask him. And there's a couple of questions here. I've got to read them first just in case. There we go. Chris, my daughter wants to become a harness driver. Jordan has come through the pony trots. She won her last two drives at Melton Saturday night, and because she turned 17 in July, she has to retire from the ponies. What's some advice? Here you go, tricky one to start with, that Jord can take on board and build on. What's some advice you'd give to a youngster starting off as you once did many years ago?
Yeah, I think the main thing is, always, get to the races, try and give people a hand. That's how you make contacts. And just always show respect to the people that own and train the horses, because, if you're just a driver, they're the ones that give you the support.
All right, good answer. Hey, Vinny and Bob Knight, there was no Vinny without Bob, and he was a tough marker, Bob, and there was Barry and Chris Alford as well. What was it, and Graham and Gavin Lang, there's a lot of father-son stories in harness racing. What was it like working with your dad?
He was pretty hard, but I think being hard helped me. Early days, like, I would go out and do track work, and if I got the times half a second out, he'd be going off his head. So he taught me the right way, and he taught me to do things properly or not do them at all, and I think that helped me down the track.
Absolutely. I want to ask you about the lifestyle of being a harness racing driver, and I've known a lot of them over the years, including you and Gavin, and we'll get Gavin on after the break too, because there was an incident that I want to ask you both about. I'm sure you were both gentlemen about it. The lifestyle, to me, it's a lot of toil and occasional reward, and you had a few of those really big moments, but day in, day out, there's a lot of miles on the clock in the car, there's a lot of time spent along on the lonely open road and flicking through CDs and things to listen to. Just for our listeners, just tell us a bit about the day-to-day life of being a harness racing driver.
It's pretty much like that movie with Bill Murray, Groundhog Day. You wake up and some days you don't remember what day it is.
What time do you get up to work? Because these days you're helping, we'll get to the later stage of your life as well, yep. But you've always dabbled in a bit of training as well, but how does the day start for you?
Just depends where we're racing, if it's a day meeting or a night meeting, and Josh Duggan, who works for us, whether he's racing as well. But generally, we start about 6:30, if not sometimes earlier, if we need to get finished, and then just get into it and go again.
And they just do lap after lap after lap after lap in training, don't they?
Pretty much, just on jog days, fast work days, a bit different. But, we get through them pretty good, and usually we're all done before we leave for the races, if not Alison just finishes up.
Do you race most days? Do you find you're driving most days?
Pretty much, yeah, we race. Yeah, you can if you want. There's races every day except Christmas and Good Friday.
What's some of the longest hauls you've done in one day?
I think sort of from home to Hamilton, which was 300 k's, then across to Nia and then back home. So it was about 1,000 k day.
Do you find that fatigue is a problem?
I don't seem to get tired. When I first got my car, I was being a usual teenager, going out, staying out till 5 o'clock and going straight to work, and I fell asleep one night and hit a post. So ever since then, I've never got tired driving.
Dale Smith told me once he had a Holden that clocked up 1,000,000 kilometres. Do you find that you look at your tachometer sometimes and go, wow, I've been on the road a bit?
Oh, yeah, to get up there, I think the Hilux I buzz around in now, it just clocked up 600 the other day. So and I got another Commodore that's done about 400, so they get up there.
Absolutely. Family is important in harness racing, isn't it? Every stable I've ever known, there's been a, a strong element where the Tubbsy was a good mate of mine, Alan Tubbs, and I know that the girls were a great help to him. And have you found that family has been a really important backbone to your success?
Oh, for sure. Like now with Alison and Katie and Sam are just about getting to the age where they can come and give us a hand at the stable. Sam will go and top up the waters while we're busy, and Katie, in between her pony stuff, will do any little jobs that we need. So it's great to have them around. And if they didn't come to the stables, I sort of wouldn't get to see them that often.
That's right. Hey, we're going to take a break in a second, then Gavin Lang's going to join us to talk about an incident. First, though, Dan Malecki, because I want to do these now before I forget, because this is the Chris Alford away from the racetrack. And The reason why I'm fascinated by one of these things is I found myself watching Netflix the other day and a documentary on Ted Bundy. So Dan Malecki sent me through a text saying, oh, here's a few things you might not know about Chris Alford. He said he's got this fascination for serial killers, but then he picked up a hitchhiker one day and thought his number was up. Tell us about your fascination for the dark side of life and your experience with a dodgy-looking hitchhiker.
Yeah, I'm not too sure where it came from, but, I listen to podcasts and keeps me going while I'm driving, like True Crime Garage and a few of those, and as you said, the Ted Bundy case, and it just seems to fascinate me how weird people can be. But I was driving home from Maryborough one day and straggler on the road. He looked pretty harmless, so I pulled over and picked him up. And where you want to go? Oh, I'm going to Romsey, mate. I said, oh yeah, I'm going close to there. So driving along, and he's telling me how he kills 700 sheep a day, and he looked pretty creepy. And got to Romsey, and I said, oh mate, here you go, here's your stop. He goes, no mate, you drive me straight to my house. Oh, and I sort of froze and went, oh, I can't, I've got to go the other way. He said, no mate, you'll be driving me to my house. So turned the corner and dropped him off in his house, and thankfully he got out, but a bit scary for a while, so I never picked up another one.
I had a mate, still a mate, Chris Bassani, who was driving around near Dapto in Sydney, and he was single at the time, and he saw up ahead, he saw these two beautiful blondes, so I decided to pick him up, and then when they sat in the back seat, they were two Swedish blokes with long blonde hair. Now, why are you scared of spiders?
Yeah, another thing, I just hate them.
There'd be a lot of them in the tack room, wouldn't there?
Yeah, they seem to get around and in the rugs, but I think it just went back to when I was a little kid playing with my cousin at my grandma's joint, and in the old days the water meters had like hessian bags over them, and we picked it up one day and a huntsman jumped straight down the front of my t-shirt and was crawling around inside my shirt, and ever since then I've just hated them.
Fair enough. I'll ask you about your gigantic cow called Bert in a minute when we talk about your life now with Alison and Sam and Katie, and of course there's Maggie as well. But we're going to take a break, and then when we come back we're going to have a look at some of the greatest successes of your career and put on some replays that might rekindle some lovely memories for you and our listeners. And just a reminder, 0416 90 50 52, if you've got anything you want to have a chat to Chris Alford about, it's 28 minutes past nine.
This is RSN 927's Racing Pulse and Open Mic.
Got a legend in the room and a legend on the line now. Gavin Lang is joining us, and Gavin's going to tell us about what the hell happened in the Ararat driver's room that day. G'day, Gav. How are you, Gav? So he doesn't want to talk about it. You there, Gavin?
Hey, Matt.
Sorry, mate. We've got you now. Yeah, you guys are good mates now. But there was a few years where there was no talkies because there'd been a bit of a stoush at the Ararat driver's room one day. What happened that day?
Oh, well, you got to forgive me a little bit. I've had a few too many reds, and it's been a long time since that happened. But I'll do my best to fill you in. Chris and I go back a long way. His father actually worked for my dad early days. Chris and I both went to the same primary school in Romsey, and it shut down not long after he left there. I'm not sure why, but it did. We both played for the same footy team, so we've been mates for a long time. And probably that the incident at Ararat was probably born out over a period of time, and it was probably more outside influences that brought it to a head. Yes, we were competitors on the track and still are, but it's always been a pretty amicable relationship, not only with me and Chris, but with most drivers in Victoria for that matter. But, like I say, it all sort of come to a head. Their influences, his ex-wife, my ex-wife.
It's a Melrose Place story, is it?
Oh, mate, very much so.
I shouldn't have gone there.
No, but anyway, that's okay. We've moved on from there, and, it did take a couple of years for us to basically get back on talking terms again, but we did. And, like I say, we were mates before. We had a little bit of time apart, but we're back together again now, and, better for it.
And, Chris, you know, you were both young guns at the time. Chris, Gavin, with due respect, Gav, you might have a year or two on, Chris, but you were both the young lions of your era about, 20, 25 years ago, and you're now almost elder statesmen, and it has been an enduring sort of friendship with a few bumps along the way, hasn't it?
Yeah, that's for sure, Matty. I remember before I started racing, Gavin used to drive my dad's horses when he couldn't, and couple of times come up to the farm and go to the races with Dad. And I remember I was going to take his RX-7 for a spin one day, but I couldn't find the keys. It was just sitting out the front. But
and where were the keys, Gav? In your Skyrocket.
Well, like I say, I was brought up in Romsey, so I knew better to leave them around, lying around.
Yeah, so I thought, you know, how good's this? You know, I want to grow up to be like him one day, have a flash car like this and the lifestyle. And, you know, as I said, we had that little bump in the road for a while, but we're good mates off the track and we race hard when we're on the track.
Gavin, I imagine, you know, a question without notice, there would have been some great tight finishes and stoushes with C. Alford over the years?
Yes, definitely. Probably, I mean, the most notable one was when we were sort of head-to-head for a Metro Premiership only a few years back, and it came down to the last race. We both had a drive in it, and, whoever won the race... come out on top for the season, and as it turned out, we deadheaded. So, that was a fitting result, giving, as Chris alluded to, our friendship and everything. So, too numerous to mention, yes.
Just a quick one. They call him the puppet, Chris. I believe they call you the puppet because of your elevated driving style. Is that right?
Yeah, a bit of that and a bit of... long story from, I think I went to the trots with Gavin and Andrew Peace one day to Gumbow when I didn't have a car, and I think I won the cup and got drunk, and they were picking me up out of the long grass and bouncing me around, so I think it sort of came from that as well.
With that distinctive style, Gavin, what's just before we let you go, what's most noteworthy about the driving style? What does Chris Alford bring to the table when you're taking him on in a race?
Well, I mean, for a start, I mean, I've seen him develop from, you know, probably what we would have called a whip driver many years ago, but we were all guilty of that. And I've seen him become a more polished reinsman and, tough to beat in any race. What are his main attributes? He's probably a good judge of pace, which comes with the territory, and... I mean, he drives good horses, but, I mean, that's okay. You've still got to make the most of the opportunities, and that's one thing he's done to get him to where he's got. So, very proud to see what he's turned into because, as I said at the top of the show, his dad worked for my dad many years ago, so we go back a long way.
Absolutely, and it's been lovely to hear you give tribute to a mate who's, it's been an enduring friendship with, as I said, some blips along the way. Good on you, Gav. Thanks for joining us, mate.
Good luck. Thanks very much, Matt.
And one thing, Chris, I reckon you achieved that Gavin didn't was an Inter-Dominion Paces final, and the most monumental of all, and this is goes back to Gavin's description of you as a driver, and you had to bring all of this to the table in 1995. You're in Christchurch. There was a champion called Golden Rain, and this is what happened.
Wider out of the track, Golden Rain is flat for Chris Alford. Token starting to come into it. We own a Warriors looking for the gap on the inside. Young Mr. Charles also. Wider out of the track, Desperate Comet, it's Victor Supreme. Here's Golden Rain coming again. Wider out to Token, further out to Desperate Comet. It's Golden Rain. Victor Supreme trying to hold it out. It's New South Wales has won the Inter Dominion. Golden Rain by a head. Victor Supreme.
What about the horses he beat? It's like I'm not reading out an honour roll, isn't it?
Yeah, well, you know, that race was over 20 years ago now, and I think five or six of the horses in it had won over $1 million way back then.
Take us through the series and the race and the horse, because it was a courageous win from Golden Rain, and you can hear in the background of the race call just how big a crowd it was. It was, you know, the grand stages that were every week in the 70s and 80s. This was it in 1995. Tell us all about that win with Golden Rain.
Yeah, it was a great day, but you know, he was a great 2-year-old and great 3-year-old. He won a couple of derbies, and he had a real quiet year as a 4-year-old, which was, you know, great planning by Noel and Jane. And then as a 5-year-old, he just took it all before him. I think he won 5 Grand Circuit races, and he went to New Zealand the first night of the series. He sat outside Choking, which was the, you know, pin-up horse of New Zealand, and beat him. And the crowd just went silent. They didn't know sort of what happened.
Well, Choken was the hero of New Zealand, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was like, you know, Farlap, I guess, for the trots over there, and no one could see him being beaten. And
Did you think when you're sitting on his outside, oh, how am I going to grind him into the ground?
Oh, no, I had faith in the horse. He was just a machine, and he just loved racing in the breeze. And the second night, we just drove him quiet and got flattened and ran last. So come to the last night, he had to win, and it was a torrential downpour. And he did the same again. He sat outside one of the best ones and beat it to make the final. And draws came out, and he drew outside the gate, which was not great, and had to go back to last and lap to go. Oh, I tried to make a couple of moves in the race, and every time I went, two or three pulled out in front of me as they race in New Zealand. And lap to go, I was last, and somehow ended up inside a horse, and thought, oh, crikey, what's happening here? And
did you ever think, this, I can't win now?
No, not really. The speed was on all the way, which was going to suit him, but, you know, we were behind 12 of the best horses going round, which was not ideal. But as we turned in the back straight, probably about 1,000 out, I went to go three wide again, and Tony Hurley, he shoved me out four wide. So I just said, right, that's it, turn the stick, give him a couple on the backside, and he went from sort of last to outside the leaders in 100 metres.
Was that the, if you, to take one memory with you in life of a great drive and a great moment, is that the one that automatically comes to mind?
Yeah, I would say so. Like, have that race over 10 times, I'm not sure I would have done the same again.
Just instinctive, was it?
Yeah.
As it unfolded. Noel Alexander and Jane Davies. Noel was a bombastic sort of character, and he was a big figure at the time. What was it like driving for Noel and Jane?
It was hard at times. Like, they were the first ones to put me on good horses, so I'm forever grateful to them. But it was difficult. Like, if I'd do something wrong, he'd berate me in the parade ring at Moonee Valley for half an hour. And I think one day he did it, and the next race I come out and won. So whether he thought it was the thing I needed to G me up, you know, get me on my game for the next big race or not. But I did drive for them for a long, long time, and they had some great horses. And after a while, I just sort of said to Noel, you know, I just can't cop this anymore.
I'm getting divorced.
Yeah. But ever since then, you know, I still drive their horses, and they come down a lot, and we've had a great friendship ever since.
Yeah, and most friendships in sport are volatile at times, aren't they? Hey, here's another replay. I've got three lined up, and this was another great one. The great Stand Start now. This is the Hunter Cup in 2003 with Mont Denver Gold.
Mont Denver Gold got off the pegs, and then Countryway's third quarter in 28. The four guy led on the turn from Baltic Eagle. Unique Icon, JB's Flash, Mont Denver Gold turning for home. The four guy, Baltic Eagle, Unique Icon. Mont Denver Gold gets out. Young Rufus struggles out wide. JB's Flash trying to get through. Challenges are coming. Baltic Eagle grabbed by Mont Denver Gold. Smooth Satin late. Mont Denver Gold hit the lead. Smooth Satin flying, but Mont Denver Gold won the cup and beat Smooth Satin, a great
field you beat. It was the great race, the Hunter Cup. I love the Hunter Cup as it was back then, and this was a bit special, wasn't it? Because your dad Barry was ill, and it was a combined effort to get Mont Denver Gold to the races that day, and to get the victory.
Yeah, that was, you know, probably the most special win. I remember we got him probably about June or July the previous year, and he was about a C2, and 6 months later had won the Hunter Cup. I think he only qualified from a stand about a week before the race. And, yeah, it was a big thrill. My dad was really sick at the time, but just to have him there, and he made the speech. It probably wasn't the greatest speech you've ever heard when he won, but, you know, that's just something I'll never forget.
Oh, absolutely. And now the race, to me, the Miracle Mile is a race that the build-up's often greater than the event itself, but that's great marketing. But in 2017, so this is on the cusp of you becoming a 50-year-old, here's probably the horse other than Golden Rain that's closest to your heart, Lenny the Shark.
In the 50th Miracle Mile, and it's Hector JJ, joined on the outer by Lenny the Shark. Lazarus under pressure, down the outer out, Waikiki Beach. It's Lenny the Shark in front, coming after it, Lazarus. Hector JJ, Smolder on the pegs, and out wide around Waikiki Beach. Here's a great go, Smolder, Lenny the Shark, the two champs. Oh, it's close, Lenny the Shark. The Shark won the Miracle Mile. This year he's won it by a nose.
Who is that race caller? Hey, this coincides with a nice SMS. What was it like having Lenny the Shark swish his dorsal fin at the top speed, and where is he now? And who does he think is the best pacer and trotter we have seen? So we'll get to that bit soon. But first of all, Lenny in the Miracle Mile, and he was a perennial Lenny. He, one of his greatest assets was he just kept fronting up, didn't he?
He did. He was a great horse. He was good as a young horse. Then he had an injury, but came back with David Aitken later in his career. And, to win that Miracle Mile, he had Lazarus sitting on his back. He had Smolder sitting behind the leader, getting the rails run, and he was a lot like Golden Rain, just refused to lay down.
Jockeys get a feel for a good horse, and drivers with that connection, with the reins and that, would get a feel as well. When you get a Lenny the Shark or a Golden Rain, when you're sitting behind them, does it take a while to get your head around whether they're any good or not before they've raced, or do you get a feel straight away?
No, pretty much, first or second time you drive them, you have that. Lenny was, he was different. He'd flop around in the warm-up and run in, run out, shy at things, but as soon as that gate went out, he was just all business.
You drove a very fast horse called Blue Eagle, and just getting back to the SMS, the best pacer and trotter you've seen, and I still have great memories of Noopy Chaos, but he was a bit of a psychological case, Noopy. The best of the best with Hopples and without them.
Yeah, I actually don't think I ever saw Maori's Idol race, but I saw a lot of videos of him and such, and he beat the free-for-all paces, so I don't think we'll ever see a better trotter than what he was. And same goes with Popular Elm. The way he could just be midfield, pull out and put 20 metres on free courses was amazing.
I had a long-standing blue with Father Glashine about who was the greater horse, Gamelite or Popular Arm, and I said Scoreboard, because I think it was heavily slanted Poppy's way, and he said Courage, and Gamelite was the... I might be wrong, but in my lifetime, the most electrifying era of harness racing was that Popular Arm Gamelite era. Is that the era that jumps out at you as well?
Yeah, I'm sure. They had some great races together, and I think it was like 17-2 Popular Arm's way, so there's not really a contest of who was better. Like, Gamelite was brave, but Poppy was just too brilliant for him.
And Christian Cullen was poetry, wasn't he?
I saw him from a long distance behind when he won the Miracle Mile. I ran second, and yeah, he was just a beautiful horse.
That Mont Denver Gold was Stansstart era, wasn't it? The Hunter Cup. I know that there's a lot of pressure from punting circles and all that to get the mobile starts, but I think it lends itself to sort of formulaic racing, whereas the randomness of the Stansstart I always enjoyed. What's your take on the stands versus the mobile?
Oh, I never had a problem with stands. Some horses couldn't get it right, but, I don't think the problem was the missing the start so much. It was just, the way we had our starts were sort of all different starters did it different, so it was hard to get it right. But, I'm sure there's a place for stands.
And because we race predominantly in mobiles, were most of the stand start, when we got to a stand start with the horses, were most of them not thoroughly educated because they basically spent most of their time in the mobiles anyway?
Yeah, well, that's the problem. See, back in the showgrounds days and that, when they were probably 90% stands, everyone trained their horses to get away, and when they were mobiles, you didn't need to do that anymore.
Noopy Kiosk was a... Did Maggie name Noopy Kiosk? It sounds like a name a child would give to a horse.
Yeah, I think it was one of the owner's daughters.
Right.
She named him from the one of her soft toys and the school canteen.
Right. And he was a great talent, but like a lot of young trotters, he lost his way. And you've got a young one at the moment called Wobbly, or one that has come through the ranks. What can you tell us about Wobbly?
Yeah, he's a really good horse. He I think he won 10 in a row as a two-year-old, and I think he's won 5 Group 1s. He just had a slight injury, and he's just come back in after being out in the paddock for 7 months, but... I think he could make it, to one of the best we've seen.
Absolutely. I'm with Chris Alford. I think this is was there a horse called Biopsy Kiosk? Or is this a typo? No, there's a typo. They're referring to Noopy Kiosk here. He ran second in the 1990 to Dominion, did he?
I know he was up there somewhere. I remember I won a heat on him at Harold Park, and he might have ran fourth or fifth in the final, but I think he went to a different trainer after that and raced in the New Zealand Inter.
All right, so 0416 90 50 52 if you want to have a chat to Chris Alford. We're going to take one last break, and then we're going to come back and talk about harness racing in general and where it's at and where Chris Alford's going to be at in about 10 years' time. It's 11 to 10.
This is RSN 927's Racing Pulse and Open Mic.
with the legend Chris Elford. Chris, if there's a utopia for harness racing, it's Sweden, and there's a race called the Elite Lop, which is the race everyone talks about, and all my mates who are into harness racing make a bit of a pilgrimage to there every now and then. And you've been there, you've driven there. What's that experience like over there?
Yeah, Elite Lop days, you know, probably like nothing else I've ever experienced in harness racing. They have like a 3-day carnival. There was about 5,000 on the Friday, which is a work day, but Saturday about 25,000, then Elite Lop day 35,000, and they just love the horses. They just stand there clapping them when they go out to warm up, and the drivers are like rock stars, and yeah, it's just amazing.
And the horses are like rock stars. I remember there was one called Varen, is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. He was a machine.
Yeah, why are their trotters so much more advanced? Well, I was going to say than ours are, maybe than ours were. Are we catching up?
Catching up, still probably, you know, a little bit behind. A couple of our better ones have gone there and sort of kept up without, you know, threatening them. But we're getting closer, but you know, they're just all trotters over there, no paces, so it's just, you know, very finely bred.
It's a big thing over there in Sweden, and it's historically a big thing here, but like everything, there's market share and pieces of the pie, and the gallops has got a strong hold, the greyhounds has crept up, and if anything, the harness racing has probably come back a peg or two. What's your perception of how it's perceived these days, where it's at, and maybe if there's something that can be done to reinvigorate the status of the sport, maybe?
Yeah, that's a good question, Matt. I'm not sure, you know, how it can be fixed. I think, you know, not betting on course, you know, having TVs and pub tabs and all that sort of hurt it with our crowds, of course. But I think we lost a lot when we left Moonee Valley. You know, Melton's a great complex and good place to race and all that, but it just doesn't have that bling or whatever you want to call it.
When the Greyhounds left Olympic Park, they had a similar issue, I think, of accessibility almost.
Yeah, well, like, you know, you get there every week, you'd wear a suit, dress up, you could, you know, race, go out straight after. Now it's sort of more humdrum, just turn up at Melton, race, and go straight home because you sort of can't do anything after it.
But the big events are still big, and I've been talking a bit to the harness racing media guys about it's like the gallops and the dogs is a bit the same for me, where the focus is all on the punt and the best ways to find a winner and the speed maps and all that, but perhaps the, in inverted commas, the narrative has been lost, and the highlighting of personalities like we spoke about Vin Knight. Maybe the attention needs to swing back to the participants and who they are and what they like and what they do, and maybe a little bit away from the overwhelming punt focus all the time.
Yeah, I think, you know, as the punters say on Twitter and that, the punters are what keep the sport going, but you know, as you said, you got owners, you got breeders, you got trainers, drivers. You know, if there's none of us, there's no sport as well.
And it was great to get to know Kimma Frenning through the Inter-Dominion and hear a bit about her story. So those stories are all still there, and they just need to be brought to the surface. And one of the big stories has been the success of Emma Stewart and Clayton Tonkin, and they are the Waller and Weir of harness racing as far as dominance and numbers go. And they've been on top for a long time now, and you're their number one driver. So what's the secret to this stable's success?
Yeah, well, they're pretty much dominant, as everyone knows, but their work ethic, they, you know, Emma, Clayton, Sam, the whole team up there, they work long hours. I've sort of never been involved with anyone that is just, I wouldn't say pedantic, but just so much attention to detail. How they work their horses, I can go to the races, and when they're busy, ring Clayton about instructions or something, and they'll still be working horses at 6 o'clock at night. They just go non-stop. Their horses are just like turning up to drive a finely tuned car, I guess.
Is there, everyone sees the sameness of training harness horses, but I reckon those who approach it differently are getting rewarded. I remember going to Peter Manning's place at Great Western years ago, and there's this huge spacious track, and he was working them repeatedly, stop start sort of heat training. Is there an evolution in the way people are training harness horses?
I think so. A lot of people do it different. We train our trotters more so, not our paces, but to a sort of European way, from trainers that I met when we were on the World Driving Championship, and that seems to work with the trotters really well. Emma and Clayton have their own way down pat. You know, they work them heat work, and they just have them fire on race day, you know, 99% of the time the horses just run to their, you know, complete limit.
And that probably affects the way you drive them too, doesn't it? You can ride them with more aggression and confidence.
Oh, for sure. You know, you don't have to think about what you're doing. You just go out and drive the horse how it feels, and 9 times out of 10 they just feel like, you know, crazy bulls and just keep running.
Absolutely. Now, life now, you're an old 50-year-old like me. You're now with Alison and the kids are Sam and Katie and then Helen, you had Maggie. So you're a big family man these days without a hell of a lot of time, and you're helping out with the training with Alison these days as well. It sounds like you've fallen into a nice sort of lifestyle, albeit still busy.
Yeah, busy, but, you know, everything works out well. Alison organises the horses and the business, which gives me more time just to concentrate on my driving. I help out when I can and get to kids' stuff when I can, which is not that often. I miss a lot of their sport and horse riding and stuff because I'm away racing, but, you know, wouldn't have it any other way.
Mental health is an issue that's being addressed on a number of fronts in horse racing. Do you ever wonder about the toll that the game takes on drivers and trainers and participants?
It can be, you know, depressing when things aren't going well, but you just have to fight through it. And, you know, a couple of my friends have sort of dropped out of it, you know, because they had a hard time. But, you know, you just got to, you know, try and stay healthy, mentally focused, and just do your best.
Are you a lifer?
In this sport?
Yeah.
I'd like to be like John Hawkes one day and just help out at the stables and stay home, watch them on the telly, and send Josh or Alison or whoever with the horses.
Have Josh and Alison been briefed about that?
No, not yet. No, but that would be nice. You know, like, spend so many years on the road. I just like when I'm not racing, stay home with Alison and the kids and pot around the farm.
You're physically confident you can keep going for another decade or so?
Yeah. Well, I'm healthy and, you know, I don't want to get to the stage where people say, you know, he should have given it away 2 or 3 years ago because he's just messing up races or whatever. So while I'm still liking it and can do the job properly, I'll keep going.
Now, you're frozen on 99 Group 1 wins, but there's a little opportunity for you at Tabcorp Park Melton on Saturday night.
Yeah, Tell Me Tales. She's a great mare. Hopefully she can get a nice draw in the Queen of Pacific, and we can bring it up because it's my birthday as well.
51. Well, looking at those 7,000 wins, it's amazing you've crammed them into such a short life. You're not an old man by any stretch, but you've had an amazing, glittering career. Chris, it's been an absolute pleasure having you in. I know you're very tight for time, so it's been a pleasure. And even though Adam Hamilton tried to steer you to Melbourne University, it's been great to have a chat.
No, thanks for having me here, Matt.
The legend, Chris Elphiser. Everyone, tune in on Saturday night to Moonee Valley, where Chris may notch up his 100th, staggering figure, 100th Group 1. That's it for now for Open Mic. It's 10 o'clock.